tracing out the faded but unmistakable three-pointed scar pattern that had been North Wind's memento from their last fight with the barbarians. Any doubts that North Wind had died and that his body had decayed away were gone when she found his squad leader button and clan totem half buried in the fuzzy crust. She pouched them and looked around in bewilderment. But what were North Wind's remains doing mixed up with fresh dragon crystal? She looked over at the huge plant nearby. She then began to get the connection between the 12 spikes arcing into the sky and the 12 spikes of dragon crystals spread out on the crust. She wandered over to the plant and circled all around it, looking at it closely. It looked somehow familiar, yet it was just a giant version of many types of plants all over Egg. On one side she saw a little lump in the thin skin. Just over it was a tiny pucker. "A plant with a carrying pouch?" she said to herself. Carefully, for she did not want to meet the same fate that had apparently met North Wind when the heavy plant had fallen on him, she reached a slender tendril under the plant and forced the tip into the pucker. "It's a pouch!" she exclaimed in wonder. Reaching further in, she grasped an object and slowly withdrew it through the constricting orifice. It was the totem of Cliff Watcher's clan. Swiftkiller could not believe what her eyes were seeing, but soon she had identified other pouches and had removed a short knife and a dark detector from them. She was finally convinced that somehow, in some way, this giant plant in front of her was really Cliff Watcher. And if Cliff Watcher is a living plant, then perhaps those slivers of dragon crystal over there used to be North Wind, she said to herself. And, she continued, as the logic drove her on to the inescapable conclusion, I must have been one of these giant plants, too, with large dragon crystal spikes in me. At this thought, she remembered that she had been annoyed by a hard lump tumbling around in her body. She had paid it no attention, since it did not hurt and she had plenty of other things to worry about at the time. But now she concentrated, and soon the lump was ejected from an elimination orifice. Overcoming her natural distaste, Swiftkiller wiped it off. It was a shiny knob of dragon crystal. Swiftkiller looked at it with awe and pouched it to use as evidence when the time came to make someone believe her fantastic story. Meanwhile, she had a problem. Although North Wind was dead, and she had his totem to take back to his clan, Cliff Watcher was very much alive, and she didn't feel she should leave him. Swiftkiller finally decided to wait. She had plenty of reserve energy. She must have built that up when she was a plant, and it would be important for her sanity to have someone else to corroborate her story. The skies stayed cloudy, and soon the trigger that had revived Swiftkiller was activated in Cliffwatcher. Swiftkiller watched in amazement as, turn after turn, the slender spikes grew shorter and shorter, and the thin skin began to thicken and become muscular once again. She was stroking Cliff Watcher on the top side when he woke up. She treated him gently and slowly coaxed his eyes out as she reassured him that he was going to be fine despite his blurry vision and weak and clumsy state. After a few turns, they both felt well enough to travel and started down the mountain, carrying the crystallized remains of North Wind with them. When they came to the highest base camp, Swiftkiller sought out the food cache. It was there and had not been disturbed by mountain animals, but the meat and pods were hard as crust. This puzzled Swiftkiller, since a well-wrapped piece of dried meat should be expected to be hard, but not rock hard. even after a grade of turns. It was the same at each cache, although some had been broken into by animals long ago. Finally, they reached the pass on the upper foothills, where they could look down into the distance and see the trooper fort. As they came over the rise, both Swiftkiller and Cliffwatcher stopped in shock. The fort was gone.
"Bright heaven!"
exclaimed Cliffwatcher.
"No,"
Swiftkiller said a moment later,
"that is not Bright's heaven. It looks almost as big, but the arrangement is all wrong."
"You are right," Cliffwatcher said. "But where did it come from?"
"I think that you and I were plants for longer than we thought," Swiftkiller said. "There are going to be some very surprised people when we glide into that town."
"Providing they even remember us," Cliffwatcher said pessimistically, as he followed Swiftkiller down the hill. Commander Swiftkiller led the way into town. When they passed the fields of crops, they both looked over the harvesters loaded down with pods, but didn't see anyone either of them knew. As they approached the town, the four-button insignia jutting out of Swiftkiller's breast got them the proper respect from the passers-by. But at the same time, the obvious youthful appearance of the troop commander resulted in strange whispers as they passed. For the first time, Swiftkiller was beginning to feel unsure of herself. She paused on the outskirts of the town and said quietly to Cliffwatcher,
"I think we are going to have a difficult enough time convincing people we are who we are, without antagonizing them. I think we had better just survey the whole town before I go and announce who I am."
Cliffwatcher could only agree, and kept looking for a familiar profile, but found none. They stopped at a military food station at the outskirts of town, and quietly relaxed and ate their fill. They took their time and listened to the conversations between the couriers as they came and went on combined clan business. They had expected to hear that there was a new leader of the combined clans, but they were surprised to learn that the name of the town they were in was Swift's Climb. Cliffwatcher inquired of the keeper of the food station about the name. After the keeper got over the oddness of his slang, he told them a capsule history of the naming of the town.
"Almost 36 greats of turns ago, this place was a barren plain," the station keeper said, "when an expedition came to the East Pole to try to talk to the Eyes of Bright. The expedition was led by a troop commander named Swiftmasher, or something like that, and he climbed up into those hills to talk to God's Eyes, and never came back. His troop stayed around for a few greats of turns, then finally they gave up. By that time, some of them were old enough to muster out, and they stayed here, while the rest of the troop went back to the border. Since then, the border has come here to Swift's Climb, and it is really a booming place, I tell you."
"Where can we find some of the old troopers?" asked Cliffwatcher.
"Where else?" the station keeper asked. "In the meat bins. Or if they kept healthy and were lucky, they are having the time of their lives tending hatchlings in the hatching pens."
Swiftkiller was initially pleased to hear that the town had been named after her exploit. But if the average Chile in the town knew as much about her as the station keeper, she was glad that she had kept her mouth shut and had let the four buttons of a troop commander speak for her. They asked the way to the hatching pens and headed off in that direction, hoping to see somebody, anybody, who might know them. The road to the hatching pens went past the face of a low cliff. As they approached the cliff, Swiftkiller noticed a bright blinking light coming from the top. A Chila was up there in front of some apparatus, and a bright blue-white beam was blinking its way across the crust to the distant horizon. Ever curious, Swiftkiller said,
"Let's go by way of the top of that rise. I want to see what is making that beam of light."
Cliffwatcher shuffled his tread in annoyance.
saying that he had had enough climbing for a whole lifetime. But his curiosity got the better of him, too, and they slowly worked their way up to the top of the cliff, where they approached a soldier. Swiftkiller was bewildered to see the insignia of rank on the soldier operating the apparatus. Instead of a trooper's button, she had a horizontal bar. Swiftkiller couldn't say anything without getting herself in trouble, since a troop commander should address a trooper by her proper rank. So she again decided to let her four buttons speak for her. Looking vaguely interested, she wandered up to the trooper, as if she were a visiting inspector. The trooper heard the military tread as Swiftkiller approached. When Swiftkiller came within hailing distance, she quickly signed off her message and came to alert.
"Troop signaler Yellowcrest, Commander," she said. "Do you have a message to send?"
"No, no," Swiftkiller assured her. "But after you have finished, could you please show us your apparatus?"
Yellowcrest thought it strange that a troop commander would be interested in such a thing as a swift sender. But perhaps she was an inspector out looking for trouble. If so, she would find nothing wrong with her equipment. In a short while, Yellowcrest was through with her messages and showed the two visitors how the swift sender worked. Yellowcrest decided that she would give them the full drill. Parroting her training officer, Yellowcrest began,
"The swift sender is the troop's method of maintaining contact with headquarters and other troops. The most important element in the swift sender is the expander, which must always be kept clean."
Yellowcrest opened the side of the box to reveal a very shiny and very clean expander. Both Cliffwatcher and Swiftkiller were awed by the size and surface finish on the strongly curved reflector.
"We sure could have used one of those up in the mountains," Cliffwatcher whispered.
"We never could have carried it up those hills," retorted Swiftkiller.
Yellowcrest, ignoring the whispers, continued.
"The light juice vial is to be filled and pressurized before each message, and the signaling valve is to be checked for rapid action under pressure."
Yellowcrest closed the door, filled a container on the outside with fluid, then placed a close-fitting plunger on top and added a weight. She then reached to the other side and rapidly flicked a small lever. Short bursts of light flickered out over the crust. Yellowcrest went on.
"The flare should be renewed every shift, and the holder for it should be adjusted to give maximum beam brightness without focusing in the far field."
With these words, Yellowcrest extended a tendril and moved a small lever back and forth, and Swiftkiller could see the beam diverge and focus in the distance. Yellowcrest, with a trained twist of her tendril, left the beam with parallel sides shooting off to the distance. Yellowcrest's Tsutrum dropped the training officer Twang as she said,
"There is more about message protocol, Commander. Would you like to have me recite that?"
"No, no, thank you," Swiftkiller said. "Very clean and well-working machine you have there, Trooper."
She started to move away. "At alert!" boomed a commanding tread through the crust. Yellowcrest froze at alert, and Swiftkiller almost followed, but instead slowly returned to the swift sender to await the arrival of a squad of well-armed troopers, led by none other than the local troop commander. It was obvious that the troop commander was flustered with Swiftkiller's four buttons. Having expected to take action against meddling visitors that bothered his communication link, he found himself eye to eye with a stranger of equal rank. Equal rank or not, he was the troop commander of this town and still in command.
"Who are you, Commander?" he asked. "I was not informed of any visitors."
"Don't you recognize me, Red Sky?" Swiftkiller asked.
"No,"
Troop Commander Red Sky replied.
"You and I came from the same clan, and you joined my troop shortly before we went on the expedition to the East Pole Mountains," Swiftkiller said, immensely relieved that the one Sheila with real authority in this town
was someone that she was sure she could convince. Swiftkiller formed a pseudopod and reached into a pouch that had not been opened since she had left the clan to join the troopers. She pulled out her clan totem and held it out to Red Sky. Red Sky shuffled nervously. He took the totem and examined it carefully. Then, still holding onto it, he circled around Swiftkiller, examining her very closely. The visitor was one of the largest Chela he had seen since his early youth.
"Do you remember this scar?" she said,
thrusting out a portion of one side.
"You gave it to me when I was teaching you short sword drill in my training camp."
"You're dead,"
Red Sky said, trying to command order back into his bewildered mind.
"No, I am not,"
Swiftkiller said, taking advantage of Red Sky's hesitation. "And I want your help in getting a message back to Trooper headquarters in Bright's Heaven." Faced with the physical reality of the huge Swiftkiller body that he had known in his youth, and convinced by the clan totem and four buttons of authority on her breast, Red Sky finally overcame his bewilderment at seeing Swiftkiller in a youthful body, when he himself was almost ready to be an old one tending hatchlings. He dismissed his armed guard. After arranging for Swiftkiller to send messages to the Central Region Troop Headquarters, the Inner Eye Institute, the leader of the combined clans, and her own clan family, he took them both down to the trooper camp, where finally Cliffwatcher was able to drop his burden of Dragon Crystal. Time, 8:05:15 GMT, Monday, 20 June, 2050. Seiko's announcement came as no real surprise to Pierre. He had suspected the time differential from the surprising rapidity with which the mounds had risen. There was no question in his mind that the job of communication with another race took priority over any other scientific mission, and, without hesitation, he went to the propulsion console and initiated the move from the East Pole to the mound formations, 90 degrees around Dragon's Egg. Because of the mass of the tidal compensators, and the necessity that they all move together to keep the tides from harming the fragile human flesh inside the Dragon Slayer, the move had to be done slowly. As soon as the new position was set into the propulsion command subsystem, he pushed himself from the console chair and floated over to join the group hanging in the air around Seiko and Abdul.
"We should be shifted to the new position in half an hour," he reported as he joined them.
Without looking up from her screen, Seiko said,
"At 1,000,000 to 1, that will take the equivalent of 60 years.
Pierre had already made the calculation himself, but there was no way that he could make the move any faster. The Herder probe propulsion systems for the tidal compensators were not made for speed. He gave a quiet shrug, which looked odd on a body that was floating in midair.
"We have a more serious problem," he said, addressing the whole crew. "After we get there, what are we going to say?"
Seiko spoke up, her eyes still on the screen.
"There is no way that we can carry on a two-way conversation with 1,000,000 to 1 time difference. By the time we can think of anything intelligent to say, the person down there who asked the question would have died."
"It's not that bad," Pierre said. "Of course, we don't know how long they live. But if they last 70 of their type years, then—"
He paused to think, and Seiko finished for him.
"There are pi times 10 million seconds in a year, times 70 years, is 2,200 million seconds, which is 2,200 sec, or about 37 minutes of our time."
"Well, that isn't so bad," Jean said. "At least we can talk with the person for long enough to get to know him."
"He is going to get awfully tired devoting his entire life to a casual conversation with you,"
Seiko retorted. Pierre took charge. "We are going to have to come up with material for our side of the conversation.
and we are probably going to need more than one communication link going at a time. Abdul, how many communication links can we set up? Without turning from the console, Abdul replied, We have been using the laser radar mapper as a communication link, but it isn't designed for that job. It has a pulse modulator and can't handle high bit rates. The microwave sounder is also available, and I think its modulator can handle up to 100 megahertz. The laser communicator would be ideal, since it can handle a few gigahertz modulation, which, at 1,000,000 to 1, would be like the bandwidth of a telephone line. You could send slow facsimile pictures through it, but nothing like a television picture. Unfortunately, the laser communication antennas were never designed to point to the surface of Dragon's Egg. They are on the main body, and one or the other is always pointed out at St. George. We will have to make do with the laser radar mapper and the microwave sounder until we can get one of the laser communicator dishes reoriented, Pierre said. He turned in midair and surveyed the faces hanging in the air around him until he found the one he wanted. Amarita, he said, put on your suit and get one of those laser communicator's dishes pointed at Dragon's Egg. Meanwhile, I will be contacting St. George and tell them we are going to cut off one of the laser communication links with them. A voice broke in from the communications console around on the other side of the central core.
We have been monitoring, Dragon Slayer.
The speaker was Commander Swenson.
Continue your course of action.
Amelita pushed off to the suit room. As she went, she called over her shoulder.
I am sure I can mount the communication dish on the laser mapper mount, she said. I can't guarantee the bore site accuracy, but they should be fairly close.
Pierre turned to Jean.
I want you to go through the ship's library for anything that is designed for initial contact with other species. Look in the fiction holomem for science fiction stories if you have to. But I think that somewhere in the ship's encyclopedia, you might find something on communication languages. Meanwhile, we will have to have something to send while Jean is searching the databanks. I will put my children's books into a computer file for Abdul to put on the communication links. I'll start with the most elementary books first, then build up to the more adult ones.
But they all presume some sort of prior knowledge, Caesar protested. Even your ABC books assume the reader knows what an apple is.
They will work if we send all the artwork with it, Pierre said, going around to the console on the other side of the main deck. Don't forget, they are going to have lots and lots of time to figure out what each page means while they wait for the next one to print out slowly on their equivalent of a facsimile machine.
Caesar left to check out Amelita's suit before she exited. Abdul had finished sending the crude pictures and was monitoring the story file that Pierre was building up on the computer. Suddenly, Seiko announced,
They are replying again. This time it is to the west of the East Pole Mountains.
Moving rapidly, Abdul read off the coordinates that the computer had flashed at the top of Seiko's screen and keyed them into his communication console. Almost instantly, the laser radar was repositioned to beam down to that point, and the messages continued to trickle slowly down to the surface. Time, 8:18 and 3 seconds, GMT. Monday, 20 June, 2050. Swift Killer's messages back to Bright's Heaven caused surprise and shock. Having once been almost forgotten, as is the case when one does not have an immediate family, but merely is one of the members of a large, far-flung clan, Swiftkiller's strange story made her known throughout the nation. However, the most exciting news for Swiftkiller was the reply from the Inner Eye Institute. Their first message back to Swiftkiller told her that about 8 greats of turns ago, the slow messages from the Inner Eye had stopped. Then, about 4 greats ago, they had started again, only this time they were much faster. The pictures had been sent with pulsations of light that could be seen by everyone,
without having to have a dark detector or be one of Bright's afflicted. There then followed a copy of the first picture. Swiftkiller let Cliffwatcher read the message string from the Institute for himself. Then they both worked on translating the linear string of dashes and blips following the message into the fringed tally string arrangement needed to make a picture. They laid it carefully out on the crust, and Swiftkiller flowed onto it.
"Our message got through, Cliffwatcher," Swiftkiller said in a soft whisper. "That climb was not in vain."
"How can you tell?"
Cliffwatcher asked. Rather than reply, Swiftkiller flowed off the tally fringe and let Cliffwatcher sense the pattern of knots in the strings.
"It is like the first one that we sent," Cliffwatcher said. "It shows Bright's eyes over the East Pole and a needle pointing to a position over the Holy Temple. Except the needle is a funny, skinny one, with a chevron at the tip."
"That must be their symbol to indicate direction," Swiftkiller decided. "It is too thin to support itself, and has odd, unnecessary, stick-like angular projections. Such strange creatures. Their symbols are as stick-like and angular as they are."
"This message must mean that they understand us, and will move to a position over Bright's heaven," Cliffwatcher said.
"I hope it means that," Swiftkiller said.
She turned some of her eyes up to the seven points of light in the sky.
"I don't see that they have moved yet."
Cliffwatcher repeated Swiftkiller's glance with his practiced astrologer's eye. After a moment's pause, he reported,
"I think they have moved.
Let me get some astrologer sticks."
They hunted down the local contingent of astrologers. After a turn of observations, it was concluded that the eyes of Bright had definitely shifted position. From a viewing point in the town of Swift's Climb, one of the faraway stars in the sky used to go behind the inner eye once every turn. Now, the point of light grazed the top of the inner eye.
The inner eye was moving.
With two-way communication established, Swiftkiller's strong, inquisitive drive took her over completely. She would have to find out more about these strange, slow-living, stick-like creatures, and their magical power that let them float in the sky, impervious to the all-powerful pull of Egg. She had many questions to ask, and her busy mind started working on ways to ask those questions in a fast way that could be done with simple pictures. But first, she had a lot of negotiating to do. She went back out to the Swift Center to send some messages to the commander of the Eastern Border and the Inner Eye Institute. Within a half dozen turns, Swiftkiller had changed professions. The commander of the Eastern Border was relieved when Commander Swiftkiller asked to be mustered out. He was wondering what he was going to do with a trooper commander who had tallied more than enough turns to have been mustered out long ago, yet, according to reports, looked as youthful as the youngest recruit. Besides, he didn't have a troop for her to command. He was so relieved, in fact, that he readily agreed to let Swiftkiller have the use of a Swift Sender. The Inner Eye Institute also had no hesitation in accepting Swiftkiller's proposal that she join the Institute. If it had not been for her brave climb into the mountains, they would still be gathering pictures at a rate of one dash every few turns. In fact, since Swiftkiller was closer to Bright's eyes from her place near the East Pole, it was decided to have the first replies come from there, and Swiftkiller would be in charge of sending them. Within less than a dozen turns, Swiftkiller had her own Swift Sender set up in the compound of the local astrologers and was beaming out picture after picture into a glancer set at an angle in the crust to bounce up into the sky toward the eyes of Bright. She was overjoyed when, after two dozen turns, she noticed that the inner eye started slowly blinking back at her. She could see it with her own eyes.
She was at last in communication with another race of beings. And she was keeper of the sender.
Time, 8:18 and 33 seconds, GMT. Monday, 20 June, 2050.
Amelita Shakashiri Drake slipped neatly into her spacesuit, her long, lithe, ballet-trained body making the usually clumsy procedure look like a dance. She carefully read through the checklist, even though she knew it by heart. She should, for she had been supervising emergency suiting drills for the past 2 years while St. George had slowly made its way across the 1/30th of a light-year distance that separated Sol from Dragon's Egg. The neutron star now lay 400 kilometers outside the hull of their tiny science flitter, Dragonslayer. She was in a hurry to get the laser communication dish repositioned, but the crew of Dragonslayer were too few in number to afford any mistakes. So Amelita waited patiently until someone came to give her a final checkout. Ship's doctor, Caesar Ramirez Wong, came flying headlong into the upper room, performed a neat somersault, and absorbed his momentum on the ceiling with a carefully programmed flexing of his knees. He rebounded slightly, and soon was hanging upside down in front of her. She noticed idly that the tidal compensators were not working perfectly on the upper deck, for he was slowly drifting up to the ceiling as he read off the checklist. Main and emergency air tanks full. Time to put on your helmet and check air and cooling, he said. Amelita was ahead of him, and her muffled voice spoke from behind the visor.
Helmet on, air and cooling fine.
He glanced back at the checklist. Magnus Diction boots? Amelita flicked a switch on her chest console that rearranged the pseudo-random pattern of the magnetic monopoles and the soles of her boots so that they matched up with a hexagonal pattern of monopoles built into the inner plates and hull of Dragonslayer. Electromagnetic boots would have been simpler if Dragonslayer could have been built out of steel, but since the neutron star and the tidal compensators outside had significant magnetic moments, the engineers had had to come up with a substitute. Amelita's boots clanged onto the floor. Each foot twisted 30 degrees to the outside as the boots conformed to the hexagonal pattern on the plate. She looked down at her feet and thought idly,
"What a sloppy third position. My ballet instructor would never have let me get away with anything that poor."
She flicked off the Magnus Diction boots, then slowly rose into the air as Caesar droned on through the checklist.
"You're checked out," Caesar said as he floated over to the lock controls. "Out you go. Try to move that communication dish to the swivel mount as fast as you can. Don't forget that if those neutron star creatures are really living a million times faster than we are, 15 minutes to us is like 30 years to them."
Amelita opened the hatch to the airlock and went in, dogging the door behind her. She signaled to Caesar through the port and felt her suit stiffen as the pressure dropped. The outer hatch swung in, and Amelita held onto her safety line as she cautiously looked out. Although she had been outside St. George a dozen times on repair jobs and the long journey out to Dragon's Egg, this was the first time she had been outside Dragonslayer, and she knew the scenery was going to be very confusing. Anything in space that causes confusion is a prime source of accidents, and she had not lived this long by taking chances and outship jobs. Amelita looked out of the airlock set in the middle of Dragonslayer. Since the ship was inertially stabilized, the stars remained fixed in the sky. However, flashing in front of the port 5 times a second was the bright white globe of Dragon's Egg. At 400 kilometers distance, the 20-kilometer diameter neutron star was about 5 times bigger than Sol at Earth and took up an appreciable part of the sky.
"If only we were orbiting around it at a faster rate, so that it would blur out in a ring," she thought. "At 5 times a second, it is right in the visual flicker band and is going to be a real annoyance."
She moved to the portal and put her head out. With her view enlarged,
She now saw the complete ring of tidal compensators encircling the ship. They revolved about their common center at 5 times a second, while simultaneously orbiting about Dragon's Egg. Because there were 6 of them, they seemed almost fused together into a solid ring. Amelita paused to get accustomed to the sight. There was a bright white globe of light circling about the middle of Dragonslayer, and at right angles to that, a ring of glowing red that twirled about the ship like a wedding ring spinning on a table. The spins of the two matched, so that the plane of the ring was always perpendicular to the direction to the neutron star. "How are you doing?" Caesar's voice came through the suit communication link.
"Fine," Amelita said. "I'm just waiting here to get used to the whirling scenery. It reminds me of the time back in the Lunar Ballet Academy, when I tried to break the Guinness Book of Records mark for the most number of fuetes in a row. After twirling around on 1 foot for over 100 turns, I missed my kick, lost my spotting point, and the vertigo got to me. I don't think things were whirling around as much then as they are now."
Amelita looked up at the top of Dragonslayer to the large central turret containing the solar mirror, laser radar, microwave sender, and other star-oriented instruments. The turret was rotating 5 times a second, keeping the instruments pointed at Dragon's Egg.
"You haven't turned off the turret," she complained. "I can't work on it while it is spinning around."
Caesar replied, "Since you first have to remove a laser communication dish from its mount on the hull and won't be ready to install it on the turret for several minutes, I thought we should wait to de-spin the turret. Once we stop it, we will have to cut off communication to the neutron star beings. Abdul is now making up a simple message to let them know that we will only stop for a short while, so they don't think we have given up and gone away." Amelita looked around the equator of Dragonslayer until she could see one of the laser communication dishes. She fixed her eyes on it, then stabilized her personal up and down. She told her eyes to ignore the bright objects whirling through her peripheral vision. Activating her magnestiction boots, she stepped out onto the hull. As Amelita stood up, she could feel the play of pulsating residual gravitational forces through her body. In addition to the pulsating fields, there were slight variations in the overall compensation, since the spacecraft was slowly shifting its orbital position from the east pole to a position over the mound formation on the star's surface. Sometimes she was pulled outward with a fraction of a G, and sometimes pushed inwards. Amelita made her way carefully to the nearest laser communication dish. She detached the coaxial cable that brought the modulating voltages from inside Dragonslayer, then the power line to the laser, and finally she started working on the mounting bolts. It was a well-designed system, with the bolts staying captive in the frame, so there was no chance of having them float away in freefall. She held onto one strut of the bulky piece of apparatus and plodded her way carefully back over the curve of Dragonslayer's hull.
"Start de-spinning the science turret, Doc," she called through her suit radio. "I'm clear of the control jets."
As she moved over the curving hull, she could see the spinning turret slowly come to a stop while the control jets flashed on Dragonslayer's hull to throw off the excess momentum. As she approached the stationary turret, she glanced upwards along the 3-meter length and found the laser radar. The radar dish was tucked under the huge mirror that brought a 1-meter diameter image of Dragon's Egg directly into the star image table. She was getting far from the airlock, so she fastened a secondary safety line to a ring at the base of the turret. She then stepped carefully off the spherical hull of Dragonslayer onto the cylindrical turret. She allowed herself a few seconds to readjust her personal up and down. Then, still holding the bulky laser communication dish, she ascended. As she climbed further and further from the center of Dragonslayer, the accuracy of the tidal compensation fields became poorer. Halfway up the turret, she found that the play of gravitational fields over her body became too strong to ignore. She felt as if her suit were haunted by tiny elves that pushed and pulled at various sections of her anatomy. The overall tidal compensation was also off, and the laser communication dish began to pull ahead as it gained weight while they made their way up the column. The increased weight was not much, but it was significant enough so that Amelita stopped at each step to move her safety lines from ring to ring behind her. She finally reached the laser radar and looped the lanyard attached to the communication dish to a nearby ring and let the ring support the burden. She fastened another lanyard from her belt to the laser radar. Firmly anchored to the column with magnastiction boots and a pair of short safety lines, she started to remove the laser radar. Fortunately, the laser power supply line and the modulator coaxial cable connectors were the same for the two laser systems. All they had to do was switch the cable on the inside from the pulsed modulator used in the laser radar to the video modulator in the laser communication console. Unfortunately, the bolt patterns for the two laser systems were incompatible, and she could tighten only one bolt. However, she had been prepared for that problem, and had brought some quick-setting vacuum epoxy to fasten the laser communication dish onto the laser radar mount.
"What I need is four hands," Amelita said as she reached into a pouch for the epoxy.
The twin tube had been designed for use with her clumsy gloves, and even had a tear-off top. But in her hurry to get the job over, Amelita made a mistake. The mistake was a very innocent one for someone who had been living in free fall for many years. All she did was to park the laser radar in space alongside her while she opened the epoxy. While she was busy with the glue, the laser radar slowly floated outward, gaining speed. When it reached the end of its lanyard, it jerked cruelly at Amelita's middle. She found herself pulled off the turret. There was a quick second of panic, then Amelita came to the end of her two safety lines and rebounded. She felt a rip as the weaker joint in the equipment ring holding the laser radar came out of her safety belt, while the two stronger personal safety loops held. She looked down to see the laser radar module head outward away from the ship. It gathered speed rapidly in the strong, attractive gravitational fields from the dense masses in the tidal compensator. She lost sight of the module as it whipped out to join the whirling ring of ultra-dense asteroids.
"We have trouble, Dragon Slayer," she said into her suit microphone. "I lost the laser radar module to tidal forces."
Amelita pulled herself hand over hand back up the safety lines to the turret and proceeded to bolt and glue the communication dish to the empty mount and then hook up the power and modulation cables. She quickly climbed down off the turret and signaled to Caesar to start up the turret again. She watched, staying out of the way of the control jets, until the huge cylinder was again spinning around at 5 revolutions per second. Then she glanced up to see an elongated glob of crushed and extruded glass and metal come whirling back toward the hull of Dragon Slayer. The sharp points of metal on the glob were emitting a blue corona of electric discharge built up from the rapid motion through the strong magnetic fields of the star. Amelita was appalled. If that ever hit the hull of Dragonslayer, they would be dead. Cursing herself for having been so careless, Amelita knew that this was no time to play it safe.
"Emergency! Emergency!" she called.
Without waiting for a reply, she began a move-by-move description of the problem and her efforts to solve it.
"Laser radar module loose and moving at high velocity in vicinity of ship. I am jettisoning safety line and will use jetpack to try to catch it."
Amelita unhooked her safety line, moved her left hand to the jetpack controls on her chest, and took off to capture the deadly missile. As she swooped around the curve of the hull, she spotted the module above the turret. It had slowed down as the tidal forces had pulled on it. The module had looped slowly in a large arc and was now headed back again toward Dragonslayer. She would have to catch it while it was moving slowly if she were going to hold onto it. so she jetted straightway up to meet it. As she flew past the spinning turret, her body began to feel the tidal pressures. She tried to hunch in her head and draw up her feet to cut down her length and relieve the forces, but it was hard work holding them in against the strong outward pull. It was worst on her head. Her ears and nose felt as if they were being pounded 20 times a second, while the top of her head felt as if she were being scalped by a savage with a dull knife. Despite the pain, she continued upward to meet the module that was slowly gaining speed as it fell again toward Dragonslayer. This is where her 2 seasons as captain of a freeball team on L5 would pay off. Her left hand played quickly over the jet control keys on her chest. She slowed, whirled about, and then accelerated again to match speed with a now rapidly falling chunk of metal. As her head changed orientation, the tidal pressures changed also. Her nose, now jerked viciously outwards, began to gush ellipsoidal globules of blood. Peering anxiously through her red-stained visor, Amelita found a short section of lanyard in front of her and grabbed it with her right hand, while her left flicked over the jet controls. The laser radar module continued on its hyperbolic path downward past the hull of Dragonslayer, and then outward along the belt line. Slowly, Amelita got it under control and dragged it down to the hull. Within seconds after her boots had clicked onto the plates, she had both herself and the distorted hunk of metal attached by shortened lines to safety rings on the hull. Her voice was hoarse from the running commentary she had kept up during the chase.
"All secure," she croaked. "I will need some help getting this inside."
"Are you hurt?" came a concerned voice over her suit speaker.
"I'm sore all over, Doc. But the only real damage is a bloody nose," she replied.
Amelita was making her way back to the airlock, moving her bruised body slowly from one safety ring to another, when she saw a suited figure rising from the airlock to help. She was only too glad to hand over her problems to the welcome crewmate.
"I am sure glad to see you," Amelita said, "even if only through a red haze. Here, you take what's left of the laser radar module. Watch out for it. When it got mashed in the tidal forces of those asteroids, several sharp spikes got extruded. They could nick your suit."
"I've got it," Jean said. "Now you get in that airlock and cycle through. Doc is waiting on the other side with a warm, wet compress for that nose. And in case you were wondering, the laser communication link is working fine. The first messages have gone down, and we have already received a reply back through the ultraviolet scanner."
Interaction. Time, 8:42:05 GMT. Monday, 20 June, 2050. Swiftkiller moved slowly through the compound of the Inner Eye Institute in Brightshaven. She was getting old, and did not bluster her way directly into the hard direction as she had used to. Instead, she slid obliquely along, letting the bulk of her still huge body do the work against the lines of magnetic force that one of Pierre's early science books had taught them about. She made her way to the Skytalk library. It was still under construction, with workers busily assembling low walls with storage bins for the knowledge that had been beaming down from the sky for almost 2 generations now. There were smaller bins for the tally fringe strings that were the method of recording the pictures early in her job as keeper of the sender, and larger ones for the new tasting plates that could accurately record the high-resolution, multi-hued television images that the humans were now using. The taste plates had also been one of Swiftkiller's many inventions. She had begun to despair over accurately recording all the subtle nuances of the human television signal in the form of knots of various shapes and sizes. She had happened upon the new technique when she had been on inspection after they had broken camp and were moving on to a new station under the westward-drifting human spacecraft. She had flowed through the remains of the kitchen for the camp, and her tread moved across an abandoned mixing plate, stained with meat juices and spices. Her ancient hunting senses had sprung into action, attempting to extract every item of information from the complex chemical spore that it found under her tread. Swiftkiller had experimented and found that her tread could taste with higher resolution and comprehension using her ancient spore-tracking senses than it could feel with her high-sensitivity tactile senses. After a little experimentation to find the most pungent and long-lasting spices, the knowledge of the humans was soon being stored on long-lasting, apparently featureless plates that burst into a detailed, full-colored image as a trained tread flowed onto it. Swiftkiller approached Skybeams, one of her apprentices, who was busily staring upwards at the rapidly blinking inner eye, a set of trained tendrils in front of him, shooting drop after drop of spice onto a fresh plate. Leaving half of his eyes devoted to the recording task, Skybeams turned the others toward his mentor. "What are you doing here, O Keeper of the Sender?" Skybeams said, his correctly formal address scarcely concealing his annoyance that the Old One was interrupting him. Swiftkiller knew exactly what was wrong with the youngster. He was ready to become the new Keeper of the Sender, and she was still around. However, it didn't bother her any longer. As she grew older, she grew more mellow, and now was actually looking forward to tending eggs and hatchlings. What stories she would tell them!
"I came to bring you good news, Skybeams," she said. "The Advisory Council of the Inner Eye Institute has agreed with my recommendation, and you are now the new Keeper of the Sender."
Swiftkiller flowed over toward him as the tendrils on the younger one hesitated. She started to form a pseudopod to stroke his topside, as she had done many times in the past. He seemed perfectly willing, but she found that she was just not interested in sex anymore. She wanted to get to the eggs that were waiting for her. She gave him a friendly brush anyway, then said,
"Stay vigilant, Skybeams. The work may be tedious at times, but one never knows but what the next page will bring a new truth to our people."
"I will, my teacher," Skybeams said, and turned all his eyes back to the sky as Swiftkiller flowed away in the easy direction, heading for the egg pens on the east side of Bright's Heaven. Pierre looked up at the flash in the corner of his screen.
"Link from Jean, library."
"Accept link," he said.
"Pulled section on math and physics. It is now queued in computer after your books. Concentrated on physics of neutron stars. Slow going, however. What next? Jean."
Pierre thought for a moment. Jean was right. If they spent time searching through the extensive ship's encyclopedia for useful knowledge on the Holomem crystals, then dumping those sections into the communication computer and out the laser communications console, it would take them forever and a day. A day for the humans, and what would seem like forever to the neutron star beings.
"Amalita!"
he bellowed. And soon a bloody handkerchief with two eager eyes above it was peering down through the passageway.
"Can we hook up the library holomem reader directly into the communications console?"
There was a slight pause as Amalita flicked circuit diagrams through her nearly eidetic memory.
"Sorry, Pierre," she said. "The holomem crystal reader is hardwired into the library computer. However, the communications console does have the capability of reading or recording a single holomem crystal at a time."
"It does?" Pierre said, surprised. Amalita floated over to the communications console, where Abdul was monitoring the latest transmission, and flipped open a small door in one side. She reached in and carefully removed a three-sided object,
When she pulled it out, Pierre could see the bottom was missing, and the interior was a corner cube of brilliantly polished mirrors.
"This is one half the scanner cavity," Amelita said, "and here is the holomim crystal itself."
She pushed a button, and a clear crystal cube about 5 centimeters across sprang out of the door, twirling slowly as it floated into the room. The corners and edges of the cube were jet black, but through the clear faces, Pierre could see the rainbow-like reflections from the information fringes stored in the interior. Amelita deftly plucked the cube out of the air, her thumb and forefinger grasping it at opposite corners.
"This has been storing everything that has gone through the console since we started," she said. "It is exactly the same size as one of the encyclopedia holomims, and we can put one of them in place of this one and read the encyclopedia down one crystal at a time. It will take about a minute to switch crystals and check the scanner adjustments, and about half an hour to read out each one of the 25 encyclopedia crystals. But that should still be faster than shoving all those bits from the library computer through the communications computer to the console."
"Good," Pierre said. "Go get the first encyclopedia crystal, and start with that."
A to AME, AME to AUS, AUS to BLO, BLO to...
muttered Amelita as she twirled down through the passageway to the library, her trained legs and feet propelling her as efficiently as her hands, which were still busy holding the holomem crystal and the corner of the laser scanner cavity.
"A complete education from astronomy to zoology," Pierre mused. "Alphabetical order may not be the best way to teach someone, but in this case, it is the fastest."
Time, 11:16 and 3 seconds, GMT. Monday, 20 June, 2050. Suck the crystal pressed the pores of his tread to the page, absorbing again the revelation that had come dripping across from the neutron-depleted plates. His thrums of joy and surprise pounded the page. From the page, they were transmitted to the floor, and thence to the entire courtyard of the SkyTalk Library, raising admonishing taps from the librarians and scholars. The taps were soon followed by slower waves, emanating from the methodical approach of his friend, mentor, and, unfortunately at this time, chief librarian, Seek the Sky, who arrived saying,
"Have you lost your senses? Or is it only that you've drained your nuclei dry trying to read those depleted plates of crystal and have gone into convulsions?"
"I am sorry, Seek the Sky. It is just that I absorbed a piece of knowledge that made my previous studies come together into one coherent piece. Here, try it."
Seek the Sky flowed onto the dusty, well-tasted crystal plate, as Suck the Crystal flowed off. From the heading on the plate, the librarian noted that it was an early plate from the Human Encyclopedia, Holomem 2, AME to AUS. It was a table in the section on astronomy.
"So," Seek the Sky said, "this plate has been tasted so often that there is hardly a neutron left on it, much less any information that has not been correlated and cross-correlated and cross-cross-correlated by the old ones many turns ago. What do you find here that I don't? This seems to be a brittle, tasteless table of stellar nebula."
As he flowed off the plate, he stamped, "What is so important about this that you should destroy